I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Azim Premji, the chairman of Wipro, one of India's leading technology companies. Wipro provides software solutions and research and development and information technology outsourcing to multinational corporations. Wipro's sales are over $3 billion, and the company was founded by Azim's father in 1946. Welcome.
Thank you.
Wipro is one of the leading technology companies, but the company today looks a lot different from the vegetable oil company that your dad started. And I'm wondering if you could please describe Wipro in the early days.
You know, we started in 1946 in a very small town in India, primarily crushing oil seeds. And then, you know, we set up manufacturing facilities to make shortening. My father died in 1966 at a very young age of 51. And I was a student at Stanford University at that time doing electrical engineering. So I had to come back in a rush and take over the family business. Very small business at that time. It was about $3 million a year.
Did you know growing up that you were eventually going to take over the business when
he died?
Not
necessarily, no. It was a surprise.
You went to college at Stanford. How did that happen?
Well, I did 2 years of college in India. And, you know, a group of us friends thought it would make a lot of sense if we could apply to American universities. And if we got into a good university, it would be worthwhile to do undergraduate studies there. I got to Stanford, and my parents were willing to finance me. So we just took off. And in those days, they only gave permission to go for engineering. You know, you were not permitted to go for anything outside of engineering because India needed good engineers. So I specialized in engineering. It was a wonderful 3 years which I spent there.
Where did you grow up in India?
In Mumbai, which is the erstwhile Bombay, the same city.
You find yourself in India, 21 mm-hmm. years old approximately. How did the employees take your coming on board?
People who were in the company in terms of leadership were extremely loyal to the family. And it was just natural that in a small company with high loyalty to the family, they would have expected somebody of the family to take over. So I was really not a threat. And, you know, I think a lot of my early success was because I got an enormous amount of very supportive coaching from them. Though my father didn't leave a very successful commercial company, he left a company with an enormous amount of reputation. Mm. Very, very high reputation, which was a major asset to build the future on.
And especially in a country like India, which has a reputation of being abundant in corruption to some degree, having a good ethical reputation perhaps set him apart.
You know, in the early days, there were some handicaps through it. There were some longer lead times involved. But our experience very soon was that high ethics was more of an asset. It got us more business than we lost. It got us better employees than we'd have got otherwise. It built employees with more muscle tone, more pride, mm-hmm. more self-respect. And it built a certain backbone and a character in the company, which has, I think, been our strongest assets going forward.
Now, you mentioned the company was started in 1946, mm-hmm. and India became independent in 47, and Pakistan was formed in 47. And you are Muslim, and a lot of Muslims left India and migrated to Pakistan. And a lot of Hindus left Pakistan, went to India. Did your family think about doing that at all?
No. And you know, the leadership of Jinnah, who was became the president or prime minister of Pakistan, knew my father well. So he was really trying to persuade him to come there as in a very senior ministerial position. But, you know, we had our roots in India, and we are very secular as a family. So we saw no reason why we should move from one country to another country just because it happened to be divided on religious lines. In fact, that was a lack of an asset to move to a country which was divided on religious lines because India was a very secular country.
Why do you think being in a secular country helps business?
I think there's more diversity. You know, I don't think you build a country on religion. You know, in terms of track record, I've been no way handicapped not being a Hindu in India. Mm. So it has proved to be right that we are truly a secular country. You know, which other country in the world today has a leader of the coalition who's a Catholic, Sonia Gandhi, has a president of India who's a Muslim, as a prime minister of the minority community of a Sikh, and has a leader of the opposition who is a Hindu. Mm. I mean, which other country can boast of that diversity in leadership and that diversity in a democracy? So it is not something which is superficial and we just thump our chest about. It's very fundamental to the economics of the country and the society of the country.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the billionaire and chairman of Wipro, Azim Premji. Wipro started off as a hydrogenated cooking fat company in the 1940s and has become one of India's largest technology firms. With over $3 billion in sales and 70,000 employees, Wipro was ranked among the top 100 global technology companies by Business Week magazine. Time magazine has listed Azim as one of the world's 100 most influential people. The company moves from a vegetable oil company to one that offers call center services many years later, and a lot happens in between. When did you first decide to start diversifying Wipro?
We first diversified Wipro in the end 70s. One reason was diversification was the style in those days. But more important, you know, we were looking for a high technology business, a business in the services area, because we believed that profitability and growth would be better in the services area, and a business where we could build a strong annuity revenue, you know, repeat revenue, recurring revenue. And we zeroed in on information technology. And one of the leading players in India, international, multinational computer company, had exited India in about 77 because of some revisions in the policy of the government of India. And they had very dominant market share in information technology. So it created a huge opportunity in terms of an entry point. And we started off addressing the domestic IT market.
Now, you mentioned in the 1970s, when you started focusing on technology, that Indian government policy changed. And they kicked out IBM. And I don't know if that's the company you were referring to, but it essentially closed the economy and did not allow foreign investment. When I think of that academically, it has a stigma attached to it when a government does that. Did you think at the time that it was unequivocally positive what the government did?
I don't think the government kicked out IBM. IBM kicked itself out.
How come?
Well, IBM, the government had a policy that they wanted IBM to bring current technology instead of selling computers in India, which they had junked in the rest of the world 10 and 15 years back. They were selling unit record machines in India in 1980. And I remember we started junking unit record machines at Stanford in the end 60s, scrapping them. I mean, they were based on cards, computer cards. You had to punch them in. They were semi-obsolete machines very early in the game. And two, the government said that you must dilute your stake in this particular area, which is of national importance. You cannot have a 100% company. And the government was still willing to give them majority control. And IBM in those days believed that the world could not exist without IBM. So they removed themselves from the country. And, you know, they tried to call the bluff of the government. The government was not bluffing. It proved an enormously wise decision for the government of India because it built up a whole local industry of information technology, which is today competing with the rest of the world. So, and IBM is back in the country with viciousness. They have today 48,000 people in India.
IBM is back in the country today because in 1991, the finance minister opened the country because there had been a balance of payment crisis where the reserves were almost zero, and it was sort of a wake-up call to India. But between 1977 and 91, Wipro was able to really develop its expertise.
And Wipro and many other companies.
People call you the father of Indian outsourcing. How did you come up with the idea to outsource your services? What was the catalyst for it?
You know, I think the catalyst was that we had built a very, very strong R&D team because in the late 80s and the early 80s, India was in a major foreign exchange crisis, you know, which necessitated the liberalization process which started in 90 and 91. And one had to really invent everything from scratch. One had to write the compilers. One had to write the operating systems. One could not import the software, you know, because the duties were either very, very high or the imports were not permitted. So you really had to build from a white sheet of paper a computer and solutions. And as the economy started to liberalize and imports became freer, we found that we could redeploy a lot of these people outside of pure R&D. So, you know, we used the expertise which we had built in the domestic market to be offered the same services in R&D services to global customers. And one of our earliest customers were companies like Nortel, companies like Motorola, companies like Intel.
This was in the late 1980s when fiber optic lines were not even put down between India and the United States. Yes. So how did you communicate with these American companies, for example?
Well, you communicated on telephone lines. They were not the high-speed lines and not as reliable as they were today. You communicated by making more frequent visits overseas. And it was not so easy.
I would love for you to define what Wipro is.
We are a company which renders, we believe, world-class solutions for building productivity and results in companies, but which are embedded deeply into giving those solutions through the use of information technology.
So what does that mean?
If you want a sense of familiarity, we compete head-to-head with the IBM Global Services. We compete head-to-head with the Accentures. We compete head-to-head with the EDS. So we have specialization in finance. We have specialization in retail. We have specialization in manufacturing.
So, for example, my cell phone here sitting on the table, what role have you played in this handset?
We are one of the largest partners of Nokia globally. We design cell phones for Nokia. We design the telematics of cars. So if you see a General Motors car or if you see a car of Nissan or BMW, part of the telematics of the car has been designed by us.
And when you say telematics, you mean, for instance, roadside assistance communications?
Absolutely.
Wipro still has the consumer business, and it accounts for 10% of sales ultimately?
Totally about 7%, 8% of sales, yes.
Some people have advised you to spin off that part of the business because it would unleash some value. What is the reason why you're holding on to that? Is it at all sentimental because that's how your parents started it?
That business has funded all our growth in terms of cash flows. So, of course, it is sentimental. And we're very successful. It's a decent-sized business. We compete with all the multinationals successfully. We're not globalizing that business. Our focus is really the domestic India market. And it's growing at 30% a year. It's gaining market share, and it's fun.
What are some of the products you sell?
We sell toilet soap. We sell toiletries. We sell light sources, light bulbs.
So when I'm in India next week and I'm using toilet paper, it's most likely Wipro?
Toilet soap.
Toilet.
We don't make toilet paper.
Toilet soap.
Yes.
What does Wipro stand for?
Our original name was Western India Vegetable Products Limited, which became a bit of a joke when we went into IT. So we took the first letters of the name and dropped the V. And that's Wipro.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Azim Premji, the chairman of Wipro, one of India's leading technology companies. We'll hear more from Azim coming up. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Azim Premji, the chairman of Wipro, one of India's leading technology companies. Wipro provides software solutions and research and development and information technology outsourcing to multinational corporations. Wipro's sales are over $3 billion, and the company was founded by Azim's father in 1946. Now, there are obviously skeptics in the United States towards outsourcing, saying that you are giving American jobs away. What is your reaction to them? What is your response to them?
The fundamental issue is that the United States is not producing enough engineers and not producing enough scientists. The United States will graduate this year probably about 70,000 engineers, when its requirement of engineers is probably at least 100,000, 120,000. And it's not a career of choice for young boys and young girls. And I think that's a fundamental problem that the country is facing. We find our attrition levels of our people here, because of demand from multinational IT companies, is so high that we have higher attrition rate in the United States than we have in India. This imbalance between supply and demand, we are giving solutions to American companies to be able to build technology. So we really work as co-partners. We do not see ourselves as outsourcers.
You talk about a scarcity of engineers in this country, but how about, for instance, the call centers in India? They're not engineers answering the phones. What is your answer to people skeptical of them who say we should have call centers here in the United States?
But do you have call centers in New York City?
We do not. Because labor is so high.
Because labor is so high. So your call centers are also migrating to your smaller towns because you're getting a cost arbitrage. So, you know, this is the dynamics of world competition. You know, I'm not saying that there is not going to be community sensitivity. There's probably much less community sensitivity on software engineers because they're not really getting displaced. They're just moving from one kind of job to a different kind of a job. So I think the more sensitive point, as you very rightly pointed out, is to call centers. What is the solution to that? You know, I think you have to appreciate that when companies and countries globalize, it is a two-way traffic. Sometimes it advantages, sometimes it disadvantages. And if the liberalized part of the Western world wants access to emerging country markets, there has to be some amount of quid pro quo attached to it. I mean, that's fundamental to the whole thing.
In fact, Thomas Friedman, in his book, The World is Flat, speaks to that. He says that economists often compare China's and India's entry into the global economy to the moment when the railroad lines crossing America finally connected New Mexico to California with its much larger population. When the railroad comes to town, noted Vivek Paul, who was Wipro's president, the first thing you see is extra capacity, and all the people in New Mexico say those people, those Californians, will wipe out all of our factories along the line. That will happen in some areas, and some companies along the line will go out of business. But then capital will get reallocated, and in the end, everyone along the line will benefit. Sure, there's fear, and that fear is good because that stimulates a willingness to change and explore and find more things to do better. So,
very well put. But, you know, you look at the IT industry in India and you walk into these large modern centers. What do you see? Carrier air conditioning. All the kids there are wearing Levi shoes or Adidas shoes. They're wearing Levi jeans. They are wearing all kinds of Western dresses. That's a product market for European and American companies. Probably about 60% of the incremental growth is coming from emerging countries. So net, there are cycles where, you know, it hurts. But then the fundamentals of economics creates jobs, including in developed countries.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Azim Premji, the chairman of Wipro. Wipro offers research and development, software solutions, and information technology or IT services to major automobile, credit card, media, retail, and mobile telecommunications companies worldwide. Azim has been called the father of outsourcing and India's Bill Gates. I want to talk about some of the cultural issues that Wipro faces. Among them, angry Americans who will call up and say, I don't want to speak to anybody with an accent. How are you training your Wipro employees to deal with American customers, for example?
We do very significant language training. We do very significant accent training. But today, even if you were to pick up a phone in the United States, I mean, there's so much diversity in culture in the United States. You can get all kinds of accents, including Mexican accents, Spanish accents, New York accents, Midwestern accents. You know, so what is an accent and what is not an accent anymore? I think at the end of the day, does the customer get a service he or she wants in terms of, you know, an end service or an end product?
Don't you think it's kind of sad that you offer accent classes?
Well, we do because, you know, otherwise there's a question of understanding on the other side, you know, because of accent infamiliarity. And what's wrong with that?
There's a little lack of cultural identity, perhaps.
But it's going to happen anyway. I mean, the influence of the West is getting so predominant in emerging countries.
We talk about American or Western influence on Indian culture. What can Americans learn from Indian culture?
You know, I think you're seeing it happening. You're seeing it happening in various parts of society. You're seeing it happening in terms of the importance of meditation, the importance of Indian music, particularly instrumental Indian music. You're seeing it happening in terms of yoga. You're seeing it happening in terms of some degree of family life also. I mean, so we bring certain strengths of more humane tolerance.
Do you do yoga?
No, I don't do yoga. It requires a lot of patience.
Do you have that patience?
No, I don't, but my wife has it. She does it very regularly for many, many years.
We talk about training employees, and you've mentioned a couple times that you try to train employees to be more self-confident.
Mm-hmm.
Why is that an issue with Indian employees?
Good question. I think one is to do with, they come from various cultures. And, you know, we also recruit not necessarily only from universities in large cities. We recruit from universities in smaller towns where the exposure to a more globalized environment has been much less, with the normal hesitation of uncertainty and fear. We believe that building self-confidence in people is a very strong prerequisite to building a culture of change. Because if people are self-confident, they're less threatened by change.
No doubt it's important, but it seems, is there something inherent in the Indian culture that necessitates this type of training in self-confidence? I don't think you would have that type of training with a group of American college grads, for example.
I think the society is more respectful of adults. Society is more respectful of authority. You know, we've been a country which was ruled by the British for many, many years. So, you know, it's a country where people are uncertain vis-a-vis how the Western nations are going to react to them on a one-to-one basis. But it is changing a lot. And now you see the community of Indian origin in the United States. It's probably having the highest per capita education, the highest per capita national income. And they're successful. You know, they're successful in engineering. They're successful in technology. They're successful in teaching. And they're successful in medicine.
You talk about, we're talking about self-confidence, and I want to go back to when you first took over the company. Did you have any issues with self-confidence taking over your dad's company?
Without question. I was petrified. I had no experience in business. It was a complex company in a complex market. It was very competitive. I was not trained for it. So one had to really bootstrap oneself and learn by trial and error in a very short period of time.
What's an example of a mistake you might have made early on with the business?
Mistakes on judging people and putting the wrong people in the wrong jobs and, you know, then facing a huge personal catharsis of changing them, which is not easy in Indian society, not because it's impossible, but because, you know, it's just not expected in terms of a higher fire culture. I would say those were the biggest mistakes one made in terms of not having a maturity of judgment on people.
I wonder, does anyone ever have a maturity of judgment on people ultimately?
Well, you improve with experience and you improve with intuition.
We talk about the company in the early days, but I'm wondering what was challenging for Wipro, let's say, even in the 21st century. What has been more challenging for you than you might have expected?
Rapid growth. You know, we employ over 70,000 people. We are growing at above 30% a year in revenue. Ours is a highly people-intensive business. So even if you build more productivity and more automation year on year, you still recruit a very large complement of people to grow at 30% a year. Biggest challenge is how do you maintain that integrity of your culture? Because that's very important for delivering consistent, high-quality service to our customers. The second is how do you globalize? Because more than 75% of our revenue comes from global markets. Mm. And we are globalizing. We've done it successfully in Europe. We're trying to do it even more successfully now in the United States. So we are in the process of setting up centers in university towns, in, you know, the more rural settings of the United States, which are cheaper. And where there's local talent available in the universities, good local science and engineering talent, good ex-military personnel who retire early, but do not get jobs in that center. And they have family roots. You know, their families in farming, their families in trade, and they would like to live in those centers. You know, places like Georgia, places like Virginia. And what we are going to be rolling out shortly is hiring college students in large quantities. You know, we want to take each center up to 500,000 people. Take them to India for the 3 to 4 months induction training, which we do, full-time induction training, with all the engineers and scientists which we recruit from campus. Then keep them in India for another 3 months to get them familiar with the global models of operation and bring them back to the place we hired them from and build a cadre in the United States of young boys and young girls who really represent our future.
So it seems that instead of being an Indian company with a global outlook, you're a global company who happened to be based in India.
Absolutely. You know, we have, for instance, 3,500 people working in Europe. And out of those, 1,400 are locals. In Sweden, they're Swedish. In Finland, they're Finnish. In Norway, they're Norwegians. In UK, they're English. And we've been able to do it very successfully there.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is the billionaire and chairman of Wipro, Azeem Premji. Wipro started off as a hydrogenated cooking fat company in the 1940s and has become one of India's largest technology firms. With over $3 billion in sales and 70,000 employees, Wipro was ranked among the top 100 global technology companies by Business Week magazine. Time magazine has listed Azeem as one of the world's 100 most influential people. In addition to facing challenges in hiring people, especially at such a feverish pace, what about geopolitical challenges? I'm thinking about, for instance, in 2002 when nuclear war seemed imminent with Pakistan. What impact did that have on your business?
Well, a temporary setback because India got on travel advisory by American companies. So it became more difficult for people to travel because of security reasons. But, you know, I think the situation vis-a-vis our neighbors has stabilized now. And, you know, I'm on the advisory committee of our prime minister. And one of his key objectives is to build much stronger partnerships with all our neighboring countries, whether it be Pakistan, whether it be China, whether it be Burma, whether it be Nepal. Even our relationship with Pakistan is normalizing now.
You now have flights from Pakistan to India.
No, but we have issued more visas in the past 2 months for travel between Pakistan and India than we have issued in the past 20 years.
Well, in a way, India and Pakistan, for that matter, has more to lose now because of so much economic growth.
Absolutely.
So a company like Hewlett-Packard, if they're depending on you for their security and their back office services, if there is any strife, they're going to leave. How are you adjusting to that? Are you creating call centers, for instance, in other countries? Or
we have built a base in China now. We are in Shanghai. We are in Beijing. We have a base in Bucharest in Romania. We have a base in Porto in Portugal. We have a base in Brazil, in a smaller town in Brazil. So we are building also, we have a base in Mexico, a small one though. So we are building a global base in emerging countries to supplement our offerings from India. Because we also need to give that geographical risk mitigation to our customers.
I want to go back to the corruption question for a moment. There's an anecdote by, again, Vivek Pal, who's the former president of Wipro. When he was working in Bangalore, I believe for GE, he couldn't get a local telephone line from his office to the factory because he would have had to pay a bribe. So he somehow got connected to the fiber optic line and was able to leapfrog the local lines. But still, he was adamant about not paying that bribe.
Well, of course. You know, I mean, but I don't think it's unique to India. It's unique to the United States also. It's unique to Europe also.
Yeah, so, you know, India has more of a reputation for that corruption.
I think because the needs are higher, because the bureaucracy is more deep, because the regulations were more frequent. I think what eliminates corruption or mitigates corruption is liberalization. And today we find Delhi is increasingly irrelevant to us. I just don't visit Delhi because most of the things we have to deal with have been deregulated, with the result that the necessity to be corrupt or the breaks or the barriers or the gates which bureaucracy can put on you has significantly reduced. I think our enforcement of laws is weaker. So it's not that we are more corrupt as a country, it's that people can get away with corruption easier. Whereas the laws in Western countries on anti-corruption and enforcements are stronger. So people are more afraid to be corrupt. So, you know, it's not something which you should just slap on to emerging countries like India and China. I'm not saying we're lily white, but you know, when a train runs on time, nobody worries about it. But when a train has a crash, you know, it's headlines in newspapers. Mm. And we are a democracy, and we have an extremely free press and a very, very speaking out press, which is a good thing in our country.
Your focus, your philanthropic focus these days is on primary education. Of all the issues facing India, why this focus of yours?
You know, the reason is that we have close to 400 million children below the age of 16 years, below the age of 14 years. We have 25 million of them out of school. We have huge dropout rates after Standard 5, particularly higher among the girls as compared to the boys. 90% plus, 95% plus of our primary education is with state government, which is of questionable standard. We believe it's a major transformation instrument in terms of intervention to build a cadre of more educated people who are better citizens of the country through primary education in the villages of India. So, you know, in our foundation, we focus only in the villages of India. In our company, we focus on the city towns. So we not only uplift the quality of learning and teaching, but it has a side effect. You know, the correlations between even a girl child who's educated up to standard 5 and 6, once she gets married, she has a smaller family. So indirectly, you've attacked the problem of family planning. Second thing which we again find is that a family which is little more educated, and I say little more educated, you know, you don't even have to be high school educated, is much more receptive to primary health care and interventions on primary health care and interventions on inoculations. So we see a tripod on it. Not only are we fundamentally educating people better, but I think we're contributing to, in an indirect way, but in a very significant way, to family planning and smaller families and more affordable families, and in some way to better environment for family health care. Because in education, we have to work with communities. We have to work with the father and the mother in a community to explain to him or her why she should keep the child in school, why she should not put the child into domestic labor, why she should not put the child on farm labor to supplement the father's requirements of farm labor in farm time.
What are some of your other hobbies or interests? What do you particularly enjoy doing?
I like hiking. I do it fairly regularly. And I take about 3-4 breaks a year. Mm. Not very long, but at least a week each or 5 days each. And I go up in the mountains. But I like to do it within, you know, a circuit of about a 6-hour drive from Bangalore. Because I don't like to ruin half my holiday in terms of commute.
Mm.
And it works well.
Well, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure. Thank you very much, Jessica.
My guest has been Azim Premji, the chairman of Wipro. Coming up, we'll meet Connie Duckworth, founder of Arzu, an organization that provides economic empowerment to women in Afghanistan. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch. My guest is Connie Duckworth, the founder and pro bono president of Arzu, a nonprofit organization that aims to provide sustainable income to impoverished Afghan women. Arzu sources rugs from weavers in Afghanistan, sells them in the United States, and compensates these women at above market rates. She started Arzu in 2003 after traveling to Afghanistan as a member of the U.S. Afghan Women's Council, a government-sponsored group that promotes private investment in Afghanistan. Prior to starting Arzu at the age of 51, Connie was a partner at Goldman Sachs. Welcome.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
What was the situation that you first encountered among impoverished women in Afghanistan when you visited there in 2002?
I felt like I was stepping back in time 2,000 years. Not only is it so different culturally, but it had been a country that was subject to almost 25 years of nonstop warfare. Kabul looked like Berlin after World War II, flattened rubble. And we went into a bombed-out school building. There were literally hundreds of women and children, widows and their children, living in this shelter. To the best of their ability, they had put plastic bags over some of the gaps in the windows. There was no furniture, no water, no sanitation, no cooking facilities, nothing. And these women were surviving the winter in this building. And I looked at them, and I couldn't help but thinking, that could be me. That could be any one of us, but for the quirk of fate of where we were born. I have to say, that was the tipping point. And I came back on the plane from that first trip saying, what can I do personally to try to make some difference?
What about citizenship? Is there a lack of formal citizenship among these women?
Well, since the fall of the Taliban, there has been a concerted international and national effort to basically include women in the future of Afghanistan. And before the various wars, before the invasion of the Russians, women did have an active role as citizens in Afghanistan. There was a constitution from the 60s. Women were professionals. And because it's a gender-segregated society, 50% of the physicians were women, So they played an active role. That was all, in effect, wiped away. And you have a generation of women with no education because the Taliban precluded women from leaving their homes.
It's interesting that this disenfranchisement of women is kind of a recent phenomenon. As you were saying, 50 years ago, they enjoyed, if not equal rights to men, better rights than existed during the Taliban era. And now we're getting back to some semblance of democracy to some extent. So you're on the plane coming back from Afghanistan to the United States thinking, okay, well, what can I do? What impact can I make? Why rugs?
Well, the first idea wasn't really rugs. I kind of backed into that idea. I see the world through a business lens because of my business background. And so I naturally think that the solution to most imminent problems is economic empowerment. So I thought jobs. We're going to get these women jobs because when a woman can earn a living, it's well documented, the first thing she'll do is educate her children and then lift the community as a whole. So not knowing much about Afghanistan, I naturally thought, well, let's open some factories. Garment factory, couple of issues with that. Gee, is there electricity? No. Can you provide security? No. Is there water? No. Well, another couple of problems, the women couldn't leave their homes to go to a factory to work. So what I rapidly learned was to retreat from that ill-thought-out idea. And the bottom line we came up with is that about the only thing that women could culturally do in an acceptable way was to work in their homes. And rugs have been made by women for millennia, often with the patterns passed down from mother to daughter, often woven by memory, although the rug industry had been extremely dislocated given all the years of war. And many of the patterns were being lost. But rugs were almost the default position. It can be done in a woman's home. She knows how to do it. And it was the highest margin product I could think of because the point of all this is to kick off cash.
And what was the reaction of some of these families or of these women whom you targeted?
We go to the village elders first, and we sit down and explain what Arzu is. And we get permission to work in the village. If the elders don't want us in the village, we go to a different village. We then go to the household level. We approach the patriarch first. And if the patriarch agrees that we can work with that family, we then speak to the women. So because, again, it's gender segregated, we have a staff that involves men and women. The men talk to the men and the women talk to the women.
You mentioned that you have male monitors and female monitors, and the men talk to the patriarchs in the family, and the women speak to the matriarchs in the family. Is there ever a problem with communication between them? Can the monitors talk to each other?
When we started our expansion into northern Afghanistan in the Turkmen area, we hired a young woman monitor and a young man. Well, we'd be getting these internet reports back. And we'd look at them and there'd be these discrepancies. And we're like, what is wrong? Are they not talking to each other? Well, then we sort of said that facetiously. It turned out they weren't talking to each other. They weren't related. So therefore, they could not meet, even though they were both employed by our company, in a public place together. So we solved the problem by hiring the nephew of the woman, who also, oh, by the way, knew some computer skills, which was good. And then the three of them could meet.
Now, is this rule a vestige or a result of the Taliban rule, or is this part of the Muslim law? Where is this rule from that the men can't talk to the women?
It's really a vestige of traditional tribal customs. And it is a very religious country, so there's definitely an Islamic overlay. But the differences we see from conservative to more liberal is vast. Our area in Bamiyan, which is the central part of Afghanistan, is a very, quote, easy area for us to work in because the people there seem much more open-minded. So there we see a greater ability for men and women to be speaking together versus in the Andahoy region where religiously the people are more conservative.
So in a region like the Andahoy region, did you face resistance among families?
We did at the outset before we had any local reputation. We were we'd face families that would say no interest. And if a family didn't elect to work with us, we moved to a different household and a different family. But I will tell you, the first time we paid a bonus, because we pay a 50% quality cash bonus when the rug is completed, we were oversubscribed in that village the next day.
So those families who had resisted initially saw their neighbors getting a bonus and getting more income, and so then they signed up?
Yes. In Bamiyan, we had researched a couple of different villages to decide where we were going to start when we expanded into that area, and we selected one village. About 6 months later, we received a formal delegation of men from the other village with a written petition signed by all the elders, men and women, asking Arzu to come to their village.
You talk about men reaching out to you. Are there men weavers? Do some of the men want to weave?
It depends, again, on the tribe. If it's traditional that the men weave, we allow them to weave. We always have a master weaver, though, who is the woman.
And is there ever resentment among some of the men in these communities that the women are getting income and gaining empowerment?
Not so much within the family itself, but we have had situations where some of the middlemen that Arzu is disintermediating, we've had men who were paying women subpar rates to weave, badmouth us and go around and tell other villagers that, you know, you can't trust Arzu, don't weave for them, they don't know what they're doing.
Has your security ever felt compromised when you were there?
We have taken the approach that we want to be as local as possible and as invisible of an organization as possible on the ground. From time to time, when violence kicks up, there'll be spates, periodic spates of suicide bombings, etc. We try to monitor this random violence as much as possible, but if you're in the wrong place at the wrong time, it's a problem.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Connie Duckworth, the founder of Arzu, an organization that connects female weavers in Afghanistan with rug buyers in the United States. She started Arzu in 2003 after traveling to Afghanistan as a member of the U.S.-Afghan Women's Council, a government-sponsored group that promotes private investment in Afghanistan. Prior to starting Arzu at the age of 51, Connie was a partner at Goldman Sachs. I want to talk about the economics of these rugs. How much do they sell for in the United States? What's the range?
The range, depending on size and pattern, of course, is between roughly $1,000 and $15,000.
How much is the weaver seeing?
There's a going labor rate for weaving rugs. So we'll pay the high end of the market rate plus 50% of that. Normally, a woman would go into debt to purchase materials that she would then use her labor to weave the rug. And then she'd turn the rug over to someone else who would charge her to finish the rug and then would go sell it. And at the end of the process would come back and say, here's your money. What we've done is we provide the highest quality materials. We've also systematically gone through and replaced looms or provided looms. A loom is, in effect, her biggest capital asset. And I'd say maybe one or two out of 100 weavers might have actually owned a loom. What we, in effect, are doing is taking her from a risk position as an entrepreneur and converting her into a salaried employee so that she has a dependable income that we pay not at the end of the process but throughout the process so she can put food on the table today.
You also are supplying other benefits to these women and their families, such as health care and education. Can you describe that a little bit?
That's the literacy classes that we're establishing in the village. That's the basic access to health care. It's transportation to clinics and hospitals for pregnant women. We've built a school in one village. We've looked at water catchment systems, and we're undertaking the construction of one of those because water is a very big area. We've been researching alternative livelihood. What that really means is jobs for men in the village. Mm-hmm. So we're looking at some small food processing plants. All of the proceeds from the sale of rugs here goes to support the entire closed-loop Arzu system. So all of the money from a particular sale does not go directly to a particular woman, but funds all of the projects.
What's an example of a woman who has benefited from Arzu?
So one of our earliest weavers was a widow named Hamida. And Hamida happens to have two daughters who are the ages of my two daughters. Hamida was a widow. She was a refugee in Pakistan, suffered greatly, and she started weaving for Arzu. When Hamida, a year after starting our literacy classes, and everyone, when we started literacy classes, was in grade one. Didn't matter if you were 50 or 12 or 25. She said, learning to read was like a blind woman getting her eyes.
I'm Jessica Harris, and you're listening to From Scratch. My guest is Connie Duckworth, the founder and president of Arzu. Prior to starting Arzu, Connie was a partner at Goldman Sachs, where she worked for over 20 years. Connie is also the author of The Old Girls Network, a book for female entrepreneurs and businesswomen. How did you raise capital for Arzu?
Well, I funded the first 18 months personally. We'll call that friends and family money. Then we applied for a seed grant from USAID, the Agency for International Development. USAID invested over a three-year period a total of $2 million.
How does one find an Arzu rug?
Well, the best place to go is to our website, which is arzurugs.org. And Arzu, by the way, means hope in Dari, and it's also a common woman's name. Dari is one of the many tribal languages in Afghanistan.
So I want to talk about your prior professional history. You were at Goldman Sachs for 20 years.
That's right.
But while you were at Goldman, you led kind of an entrepreneurial life to some degree within Goldman Sachs. What is an example of a project that you started within Goldman?
Well, I was tapped in 1990 probably by Bob Rubin to start a diversity initiative. Now, sitting here today in 2007, you think, well, what's so novel about that? At the time, that was not a word that was widely utilized, certainly not in Wall Street, but anywhere in corporate America. It was an undefined term. And so I was told to start this, and I had no idea what this was. But over the next 5 years, we basically implemented all of the family-friendly type policies, job sharing. We had the first daycare backup center in Wall Street in New York, where people whose child care fell through could bring their child, man or woman, bring their child for the day. Maternity, adoption leave. So really all of the kinds of policies that help improve the workplace and the work environment.
You mentioned that Bob Rubin came to you. He became later the Secretary of Treasury during the Clinton administration. I've heard that he said, "I hear you can get things done." Why did you have that reputation at Goldman, do you think, for getting things done?
Well, I think it comes from having grown up in the bond department, which is the, for those who ever read Liar's Poker, that book from the 80s, it was very much transaction-based. And so we were trading hundreds of millions of dollars of securities in a single trade at a single moment. And so execution was paramount.
Now, in addition to word of mouth and having people just go to your website to buy the rugs, you've also had cocktail parties at Goldman Sachs, for example, where you have all women of all ages come and buy these rugs.
Oh, yes. The firm has been very supportive and also is the proud owner of some Arzu rugs for the executive floors. One of the benefits of having a long business career is that it gives me a good Rolodex, and I have been quite shameless in levering that Rolodex to ask people for help.
After you left Goldman, in addition to starting Arzu, you also wrote a book called The Old Girls Network, which tries to help women entrepreneurs and women in corporate America kind of deal in a man's world. What were some of the issues that you faced being a woman at Goldman Sachs?
When I first got out of business school and was even applying for jobs, I was still being told, now this is ancient history, but in the late 70s by some of the companies that I interviewed with that, well, we don't hire women. Now, you definitely wouldn't hear that one today, but I would say basically I've typically been the only woman in the room. And now I sit, from a business perspective, I sit on several corporate boards. And that seems to now be, at least in popular press, one of the last bastions of male-dominated business arenas.
It's striking to me, and this might seem ridiculous at first, the similarities almost between the women you're trying to empower in Afghanistan and the women you've tried to promote here in the United States, whether it's through your book or through Goleman, just this notion of financial independence.
I think that's a very interesting observation because I do very much see the linkage. I have come to believe over the course of my career that there's a dignity that comes with work. I think that, and I see it in Afghanistan, I think the right to work and to have a value placed on your work is really a basic human need and a basic human right.
In your book, I was struck there was a female pioneer venture capitalist receiving an award, and she comes up on stage onto the podium to receive the reward. And she said, "Does this microphone work for women too?"
I have a little personal saying, which is she who writes the check controls the agenda. And I think that's true in politics. I think it's true in business. I think it's true in every venue.
Thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you.
My guest has been Connie Duckworth, the founder of Arzu.
To learn more about the show, visit our website at fromscratchradio.org, where you can download a podcast on iTunes, follow us on Twitter, or join us on Facebook. I'm Jessica Harris, and this is From Scratch.